The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. We talk about those things that affect how our world is better. We talk about a variety of topics because a lot of different things can make our world a better place. We talk about businesses that have certain social responsibility. We talk about public policies that can impact the world. We talk about people who are doing things to kind of help their neighbors and make the world a better place. We talk about programs that are seeking to uplift communities and deal with particular problems that people may have. But you know, now that we have kind of finished the Christmas season and all its big celebrations and New Year's Eve, January can be kind of a little bit maybe of a sleepy month, not too much to celebrate, but there are some things that are going on in January. Kind of from our Catholic perspective, we do celebrate National Migration Week. Now, let's be honest, it's not a biggie in terms of the whole world knowing about it, but we try to raise up the issue of migrants, and certainly in this day, as we've spoken about a lot on this show, migrants are a part of the world we live in. 65 million people throughout the world are out of where they would like to live. In other words, they've been displaced. 43 million of them displaced from their own countries, a lot in the Middle East. But, you know, there are millions who have been displaced in Colombia, in South America, because of the drug epidemic, the drug wars that have been going on there for decades. And another 23 million actually are displaced from their own countries and have had to go to other places. Refugees is kind of the technical name that we give for those displaced persons who have crossed borders, whether they be in Jordan, whether they be in Lebanon, Syria, a lot of places in the Middle East where there are a lot of displacement and a lot of refugees. So as we celebrate National Migration Week, we're going to speak about later in the show what's going on with some of the people who kind of came here as not quite refugees, but brought here by their parents. We're going to speak with Laura Garcia, who is working in Orange County, not Orange County, California, but Orange County, New York. And she's working with that community and some of the experiences that she has there and her own situation as having come here as an immigrant, as a young person. So we're going to speak with her. And because just in a couple of days, we're going to be celebrating the national holiday of celebrating the birthday of Martin Luther King, we're going to be speaking with the first guest, Brother Tyrone Davis, who's the director of the Office of Black Ministry of the Archdiocese. And we're going to speak about Dr. King, his legacy, and, you know, particularly we'll touch on, you know, is Dr. King passé? I mean, for young people today, I mean, he was born in 1929, which would, you know, make him in his late 80s today. And does he still resonate with young people? So I'm delighted that we're going to be speaking with Brother Tyrone Davis about Martin Luther King and some of the aspects of his legacy now, you know, many years after he was assassinated. So Tom, do you have any news items that you want to share with our listeners?
I do, Monsieur. You know, you mentioned earlier in the show that we're in the month of January. Of course, everyone knows how tremendous cold has come to grip not just our own country, but all the way around the world. And interestingly, Catholics are responding to that cold, both here abroad and overseas. First of all, one interesting little tidbit here, Monsignor. On this past Sunday, the Papal Charity Office over in Rome announced that the shelters that it was operating in the vicinity of the Vatican, they would keep open day and night in order to keep homeless people in the area from the unusually cold spell in Rome. It's been under freezing. And it's interesting, when you look at photographs, you'll see there's icicles all over the fountains in the colonnade in front of the, you know, in front of the Pope's basilica there, Monsignor. So the charity office also announced that it would be positioning cars it owns in the area surrounding the Vatican, so homeless people who do not wish to move from the usual areas can find shelter there. And here in our own country as well, our Catholic Charities agencies have been responding in Fort Collins, Colorado. They've had a terrible winter emergency there. It's been very, very cold. And so that triggered Fort Collins' emergency weather shelter plan, which kicks in when the National Weather Service declares a severe winter storm warning or wind chill advisory. It's been below 0 degrees Fahrenheit in Colorado, Monsignor. So
what are they doing?
So what they're doing is they started a new program there called A Safe Place to Rest that's aimed at sheltering homeless men and women in need throughout the winter. It opened back in November. And they have been open to capacity there, Monsignor. And what they're doing is they're bringing the people in. They're allowing them to shelter in place. They generally ask the people to leave during the days, but they're keeping the shelters open 24 hours now for them. They're providing them with food and some hot beverages in order to be able to wind up keeping them warm. But, I mean, the need is very, very great, as they say. And they've also overturned a policy. They had had a policy beforehand that they would actually, if someone had been drinking, they wouldn't wind up letting them in. But they've lifted that policy for this terrific cold snap.
You know, it's interesting that I don't mean to make light of it. I mean, the cold is just absolutely tremendous. But I'll be just very personal about this. And I've said this to a lot of different people. I myself tend to be pretty sensitive to the cold, and I've often said is if I were a spy, all they'd have to do is tell me to go outside, and I'd tell them all the information. If I just walk a block or so, I'm frozen. So when I see somebody on the street who's kind of there all day, and they're actually sitting on the sidewalk, maybe they're sitting on a cardboard box or something, I'm saying to myself, that's got to be really, really an awful, awful situation that it is, and that we have so many people on the street. It's just a tragedy. And, I don't want to blame society. I don't want to blame the individual. I just want to figure out how we do better in terms of not having people out on the street in this really, really cold weather. There's got to be a more dignified way to do that. And there is a more dignified way to do it. And many cities are trying to respond to it. Catholic Charities tries to respond to it. And in New York, we're responding to it by, we've participated in opening a place where about 30 individuals can come in off the street without a lot of rules and regulations, because sometimes that turns people on the street off. And, the reality is that most of the individuals on the street have some type of emotional illnesses that they're dealing with, which maybe cause them to be fearful about accepting help, fearful about living in a closed environment. So it's a real challenge to do it, but it certainly, makes me feel very, very awful. And how do we do better in terms of doing that? So as we're in January and it is cold in many parts of the United States and in many parts of the world, that issue of people who are on the streets is something that gets raised up, and how do we respond to it is something that we need to figure out and address to help people to live in greater dignity. So let's now go to our first guest. Our first guest is Brother Tyrone Davis, who is the director of the Office of Black Ministry. And, in terms of disclosure, I want to say I consider Brother Tyrone to be a great colleague, a very wonderful, warm colleague, and a friend with whom I've been privileged to work with for a number of years. And he makes a kind of great contribution, as we say, to making our world a little bit more just and a little bit more compassionate. Brother Tyrone Davis, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Well, thank you very much, Monsignor. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Okay, so let me just cut right to the chase. Brother Tyrone, is Dr. Martin Luther King, whose birthday coming up, is he passé? Does the new generation, do they care about him and his legacy?
That's a good question. It's an appropriate question. I would say that he is not passé. However, I think there is there's cause for concern about how connected our young people are, how aware they are of Dr. King and of what he stood for and his message. So he is not passé, and I don't believe his message is passé either. As a matter of fact, I would probably say that his message is even more on point today in so many ways than it might have been in the 60s.
You know, I think that's a really, really good distinction that you make, that the difference between somebody's message still being relevant, being on target, and is the message still being heard? And are people kind of paying attention to it, or are they aware of it? And that's probably, that's a really good distinction that you make. So let's deal with that question. Obviously, you spend a lot of time and kind of very effectively trying to get the issues about which Dr. King lived and worked on out. So what do we do to try to make sure that that incredibly relevant message is heard by the next generation?
Yeah. And if I might also expound on that a bit, you know, I don't think there's a problem with the message of Dr. King. I think there's a problem with the messengers of today. And in many cases, those messengers that I'm referring to are ourselves as teachers, ourselves as parents, ourselves as church leaders. And maybe some of that problem is based upon just, oversight. We who were around during the time of Dr. King, that it was hard for that message not to impact us. As I was saying recently to one of my brothers in community, who's a teacher at one of our high schools, I would wonder whether many of our young people would even recognize the voice of Dr. King if they heard it. For many of us, if someone played some recording of Dr. King, we would immediately recognize the voice of Dr. King, and it would be cause for us to perk up and be attentive. But maybe we, the messengers of today, the leaders of today, the adults of today, have failed to tell the story to our young. There's a saying in the Black community, we have failed to tell the old story of how we got over. And as a result, they know very little about Dr. King other than the fact that they have a day off, and they're grateful for that. We must do better.
Okay, and that's a very kind of interesting point. I wonder if, you know, the issue with kind of telling the story of Dr. Martin Luther King, in some senses, it's probably the same. There are a lot of similarities in how do you just tell the story of anybody who was a very important figure.
Sure.
But there might be some uniquenesses to Dr. Martin Luther King in telling that story. Are there uniquenesses, you think, with telling his story and his message and trying to pass that on?
Well, I think that when we look at some of the issues that are really still so prevalent today, issues like race, issues like poverty, issues like violence, issues like immigration, those are issues that we are dealing with today, and those are issues that I have to believe that Dr. King's messages in the 60s might still would resonate with those who are experiencing those issues and those problems. Who are anxious over those issues, and who yearn for a voice and a word. And I think that Dr. King's message would resonate as strongly in our time as it did in his time, if only we were to share that message and also to help the young people of today to make that connect.
We're speaking with Brother Tyrone Davis, who is the director of the Office of Black Ministry of the Archdiocese of New York. And as in a few days, we're going to be celebrating the national holiday, the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. We're speaking about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, but in a very special way. We're speaking about how does that legacy get passed on to the next generation. And how about some of us who maybe personally kind of experienced some of the charism, some of the power of Dr. King's message? What do we do to make sure that that is alive? Now, Brother Tyrone mentioned that, you know, maybe people wouldn't even recognize his voice. So, Brooke, let's play 30 seconds of his I Have a Dream speech so that we can have our listeners hear it again.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
So, I clearly, Darren, I recognized it, you recognized it, but what you're saying is there might be some of our young people that would not have recognized that voice.
I believe very much that would be the case. And if I might kind of recall another passage or quote from Dr. King, which we have been using or are using this year as a theme for our celebration of the family and Black History Month. As Dr. King spoke about, the measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy. Now, that came from one of his writings in 63. I think that is really a tremendous challenge for us today when there are so many people who are living with anxieties about their daily lives. They are unsure as to where their country stands. So they may even at times be unsure of where their church stands on certain issues that impact their lives and their families so heavily.
So if
we listen to Dr. King, he's saying that's the measure of a man or a country or a family, is how we address those kinds of things, not how we do things when we are comfortable.
So, Brother Tyrone, let's now go to one of those issues that I think is really at the center of one of the anxieties, one of the difficulties that we're dealing with. And I want you to go back a few years then when you were an assistant district attorney in Brooklyn, because you worked closely then with the community there. You also, as an assistant district attorney, had to work closely with the police. And, you know, from my just reading the media, looking at the media and stuff, one of those issues that we're really dealing with as a country today is the issues of the community and police and some of the racial tensions that have really bubbled up and boiled over in some of those communities. Where do we use the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King to deal with what I would say is somewhat of new issues in new ways? Obviously, their continuation. Right. What's the legacy saying to this particular problem that we're dealing with as a nation?
Well, I think when we look at Dr. King and his history and how he ministered, I think we certainly would have to recognize that Dr. King was not a person who shied away from, number one, having the conversation, that we must be willing to have difficult conversations with each other across bounds of race and ethnicity and nationality and faith. We must be willing to have those conversations. We must be willing to have conversations about, what is the role of police, of people who have a responsibility to protect all people. How does that relate to how they see and respond to the varying segments of our community and the various challenges of our daily lives? You know, I think we would not disagree that the job of a police officer is most challenging. It's extremely challenging, even on the best of days. And yet somehow we've got to see each other. And we've got to sometimes confront our prejudices, our lack of familiarity. If we're going to be able to operate effectively and live effectively with one another. And so I think he would be on the front lines of saying we need to have a conversation about this issue. We need to be having conversations between police and community. We need not to shy away from those kinds of things. We need to stand up when we think that something has been done inappropriately in the community. Going back to this quote, Dr. King is talking about we need to stand in moments of controversy and challenge. We need to stand up and speak out. So I think he would be very much talking about the need for us to talk with one another, to speak out, to stand up. Maybe if we use a phrase from his time, even if necessary, to sit down and sit in. That we need to be able to do those kinds of things if we want to find ourselves on the other side of controversy and conflict.
And so let me just go one step a little bit further. Obviously, in the environment we're in, there appears to be a lot of division, a lot of mm-hmm. anger, people mm-hmm. shouting at each other. A lot of stuff now gets done by Twitter, by Facebook, as opposed mm-hmm. to kind of talking with one another. How, with a new generation that is into so much social media, how do we foster that constructive dialogue, which can be difficult, but in a way that mm-hmm. does move us forward?
Right. And I think that dialogue goes back to my earlier point, that conversation, the telling of the story, really has to begin in as intimate a setting as a family. There needs to be those conversations at the levels of family. There need to be those conversations at the level of school. There need to be those conversations at the level of church, conversations that involve young people, not speak to them or over them, but involve them. Again, referring to our theme for the Black History Month, which is only a few weeks away, one of the suggestions that we make for the Day of the Family is taking that quote from Dr. King, that idea of the ultimate challenge, the ultimate measure. We're asking families to sit down and have a conversation about what would you stand for? What are you willing to stand for? What do you believe in that would prompt you to stand up and take a position? And even for young people, no matter how young they are, I think that's a conversation that they might have. But oftentimes we leave our young people to their electronic devices, and so we don't have those conversations. And then the result of that is, people spill over with their anxieties onto the street, where there's definitely very little conversation going on the street.
Brother Tyrone Davis, thank you so much. You've been generous with lending us a good amount of your time, and you certainly have enlightened our listeners, and I'm just delighted. And thank you so much. Not for merely
it's
being
been my
with,
pleasure, Monsignor.
Okay, for the work you're doing and raising up, and you challenge us to pass on that legacy so that young people and next generation can understand the legacy of Dr. King, but also how that mantle is passed not to merely the leaders, but to everybody in the community to
exactly.
try to foster that. So thanks for being exactly. with us. Brother Tyrone Davis, the director of the Office of Black Ministry of the Archdiocese of New York. This is Just Love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. This is January, a little bit of a dead month after the holidays, after Christmas, after New Year's, but a lot going on this month, even though it might be a sleepy month. Obviously, in just a couple of weeks, we're going to have a new president. Inauguration was there. We had last week the swearing in of the new Congress. And, you know, probably in the next few months, we're going to have the debate over a new Supreme Court justice. So, you know, sometimes I think we forget that there are three branches of government and that they all kind of have a little bit of their own cycle. They're obviously interrelated. And so, you know, there are inaugurations and there are seasons for all the branches of government. So, you know, January could be a sleepy month, but it's a month in which there is a lot of transition going on. And as kind of I talked a little bit with our first guest, you know, there's a lot of anxiety going on, too. And so in a few minutes, we're going to speak with Laura Garcia, who is an immigrant who is working with immigrants in the Hudson Valley, about some of that anxiety to see what's kind of going on in those communities because of some of the really, really bad rhetoric that has emerged in our country in the past year or so concerning immigrants. So, Tom, any more news items that you want to share with our listeners?
Sure, so, you know, you mentioned there's a lot going on, and one of the things that's, I think, a way to address, and we're talking about addressing problems on the show today, you know, one of the ways to address problems can be addressed closer to home. And interestingly, Monsignor, Catholic Charities on Staten Island and CYO this past week announced that they're going to be getting a new program. It's called Staten Island's Heart Initiative. And what it's going to do is it's going to try to, in a way, stem a tide of drugs that has begun in the community. And very sadly, in 2016, almost 90 people on Staten Island died of drug overdoses there.
How many, Tom?
90. Okay. Close to 90 people on Staten Island died of drug overdoses. So what the Catholic Charities on Staten Island and CYO are going to be doing is they're starting the HEART Initiative, which stands for Heroin Epidemic Archdiocesan Response Team. And it's designed to target youth on Staten Island community and use the Catholic Youth Organization, its coaches, and its members to inform, assist, and encourage families to combat this drug scourge. Staten Island Heart Initiative is partnered with Staten Island University Hospital, where coaches are going to receive Narcan training. Now, Narcan, Monsignor, is a drug that can actually reverse the effects of opiate overdoses. So the coaches are going to have training and the refs are going to have training in that, as well as there's going to be the ability of families to call either one of two places, Carl's House, which they can refer if someone is in need of treatment, they can refer them to a proper facility, or Catholic Charities Parish Counseling Network, which is going to be offering counseling sessions to families in need at a very reasonable rate. So I think that, you know, it's good that I think that this is being addressed, Monsignor, and I think, you know, Catholic Charities is out in front of it.
Well, I think, Tom, what you point out is something that is an issue that we need to deal with, and I think I'm delighted that Catholic Charities Staten Island is taking the lead in some of the raising of awareness, prevention activities that are there, and because we touch a lot of young people who are involved in sports. And the reality is, so people say, well, they're good kids. They don't get in trouble. Well, that's not true. That's not true. That sometimes good kids do get in trouble. And the time to try to address those is prevented, to prevent it from happening, as opposed to trying to have all treatment programs. And so, you know, every now and then, I think sometimes we say, oh, well, it's not my problem. Well, it is our problem. It's a community problem. And what they sometimes say, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. We never know when a problem might strike us. And even if we think we're immune to some of the difficulties that we better be a little bit more humble and realize that all of us are susceptible to falling into patterns and doing things which, you know, are problematic, even if we thought we never were going to be in those situations. So I'm delighted that this HART initiative, which quite frankly is one of the major new centennial initiatives that Catholic Charities is undertaking, because Catholic Charities is 100 years old in 2017, and we're looking not merely back at what happened 100 years ago and having a big party to say, hey, we're 100 years old, congratulations to ourselves. No, what we're doing is saying, hey, yeah, we've been around for 100 years, but we're looking forward as to what are some of the new things that we can even help more people. How can we give people greater hope in their lives? And one of the things we identified, sadly, is that we do have a heroin and opioid addiction in a lot of parts of this country. And so we're taking the step to figure out how we can make people's lives better by helping to not have them fall into that problem. So, Tom, thanks for raising that up. Let's take a break, and then when we come back, we'll go to our second guest, Laura Garcia, and we'll talk about the situation of migrants. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, your neighbor, yourself, and the world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, your neighbor, yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We're in the month of January. After all the holidays, we're dealing with some issues which are really important. We're getting ready to celebrate Martin Luther King Day, but we're also celebrating within kind of our church circles National Migration Week. So I am delighted that we have as our next guest, Laura Garcia, who is working now in Orange County in a program which is trying to promote racial justice in that area. Laura came to the United States as a young person, and she is one of those individuals who's the beneficiary of the Deferred Action program that was put in place a number of years ago to permit those who immigrated to the United States as children, to be given authorization to work and to be able to remain in the United States. So I'm delighted that Laura is with us. Laura Garcia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Monsignor. It's a great honor.
Well, thank you so much. Laura, could you just maybe briefly share with our listeners a little bit of your journey, how you got to where you are, where you came from, and just a little bit of your journey and story?
Sure. My parents decided to come to this country when I was just 8 years old, and we arrived in New York State. I grew up here. I've been here for more than 24 years. In that time, we tried to apply for an immigration relief program in 2001, and unfortunately, we never got a response after the 9/11 attacks. My family grew frustrated and eventually moved out of the state, and I stayed behind to try to finish college. My father came back to New York in 2008, and unfortunately, he was deported for a small traffic violation. And soon after he was deported, my mom followed, and he was sent. She moved back to Mexico with him, and so they live there now. I also have a younger brother who did come with us, but when he was just 12 years old, my family decided that it would be best for him to go back to our country, and he grew up in Mexico, and so he lives in Mexico as well. So all of my immediate family lives out of the country. I was the only one that stayed behind from our family, and I was able to apply for DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, in 2013, and ever since, I've been able to have a lot of opportunities to not only work for my community, but to have a voice for my community, and I currently work for this non-for-profit organization called the YWCA, where I'm the Racial Justice Program Manager.
Great, Laura. That is a great little summary. So, but let me ask you a little bit more, because some of our listeners may not be completely familiar with DACA or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. Can you explain to our listeners what that means? Because it is something that there's a lot of conversation about today and how that came about. And give our listeners just a little bit of sense of what that means and who was eligible for it.
Sure. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals is a executive action that President Obama announced in 2012. This was something that was fought for years before that happened, with many of us undocumented students who came here at a very young age, not knowing that we were coming to this country and that we were going to be treated as criminals. And so we pushed for some type of legislation. And even though the executive action is not legislation because it can be removed and taken away with just a simple signature by the next president, this program really helped a lot of undocumented youth who grew up in this country, who have gone to school in this country, who have tried to make a difference in this country, to come out of the shadows and to participate even more in our local communities. With this program, we can have a driver's license. We can work in many areas. We've been able to really make a difference within our communities because it's allowed us to be more free in terms of being able to change things that we couldn't before and to speak up. So with this program, we can do so many things that we weren't allowed to do, and now we are in fear that it might be taken away by the next president.
So, Laura, thank you. I think that was a very good explanation. And, you know, I do have to say this, so I'm going to say this to our listeners, and I'm just going to share with you a conversation I had among my own family over Christmas time when one member of the family was speaking about immigration matters. And quite frankly, my relative, so I can say he didn't know what he was talking about. Okay. He didn't know what he was talking about in the reality of what was the issue we were talking about at that time. But I want what Laura has said, and I think is very, very kind of important. Yes, when Laura came here, she was in a situation where she was brought by her parents in which she was out of status. She didn't have the right documents. And then what this executive order did by the president, it wasn't a piece of legislation, but it wasn't that it said, okay, everything's fine now and you're a citizen now and nothing's there. No, first of all, you had to meet some qualifications. In other words, you could only apply for this if you were studying or graduated from high school, if you had some type of educational requirements, or if you'd been in the military and honorably discharged from the military. And here's the point I think is really critical. You weren't eligible for it if you had been convicted of a felony or a felony crime. So that, in other words, it wasn't just, yeah, everybody got in. It was like, if you met certain, which I think most people would say were very reasonable criteria in order to do that. And now, and that's the situation that Laura is in. And so that's what, you know, we're talking about in terms of, since it was done by an executive order, could be overturned because it's not permanent. But that's the reality of what is being talked about. And Laura, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are about 750,000 people in the United States who kind of successfully applied for this deferred action. Is that about right? Somewhere's around that number?
Correct. And it's been really hard to try to help anyone to apply for DACA. I've done a little bit of work with that. And to put together the evidence to prove that you've been here from 2007 until currently, it's one of the most hardest things that any undocumented person can do, because most of the time we don't want to leave a trail. We want to be in the shadows, and we don't want people to know where we are.
Right.
So not only do we have to find that evidence, now we've exposed ourselves with everything about us to the government, who can decide to come knocking on our doors and deport us if they wanted to.
So, again, one of the things we've been trying to do very carefully in light of some of the policies that have been proposed, some of the rhetoric, which, quite frankly, is very harsh and very disturbing. But what we've been trying to do is communicate a balance. We don't want to heighten the level of fear in our immigrant communities, but at the same time, we want to be realistic about some of the negative things that could possibly happen if certain policies are changed. So, Laura, what I'm kind of asking you as a person who's working on the ground, what is your read or your sense of the level of anxiety or fear among our immigrant communities?
Well, it not only affects some of my family members, but it affects me directly as a DACA recipient. The fear is very much alive, and it's always been as an undocumented person, because I'm still considered undocumented. It doesn't matter that I have gone to school here. It doesn't matter that I've done a ton of community service work. It doesn't matter what kind of work I do now. The fact that I'm undocumented, I'm in the watch. And so what my community and my family members fear is that because of the new precedent, things might change drastically for us. And the fear is more alive now more than ever, because we hear it in the streets. We see it in our community. We see it every time we turn on the news. And so as much as we don't want to fear and show fear to the younger generations, everybody is aware of the situation. And I myself, as a person who went out and helped people register to vote, it didn't matter what party line they were in. My hope was just to have them have their voice heard and vote for who they wanted to vote. And it's been really hard to know that I participated in that, but that's what I believe in, that everybody has the possibility to do what they need to do in this country to make the changes that they need to do And so, unfortunately, right now we live in a state where everybody that's undocumented is terrified. And even I am afraid to continue to speak up because I can be a target. But I've been through this before I came out of the shadows. And I refuse to allow fear to control anything that has to do with me in pushing forward to helping my community.
Well, Laura, thank you for coming on the show, and I thank you for what you're doing. But I want to go beyond, and I want to talk about, because it's not merely about your immigration status, some of those fear. You're actually working right now. You're contributing to this country. You're making this country a better place. So what I want you to tell our listeners about, tell us about the work you're doing now, and what is it, and what's it trying to make a difference in whose lives?
Right. I recently went to California. I was picked as a representative for the Mexican consulate to attend a workshop where we invited about 120 DACA recipients from all over the country. So I was able to meet a lot of people just like myself from all over the country, from California to Florida to Nebraska, all over the country. And what I was able to see is that I was surrounded by teachers, by lawyers, by future doctors, by individuals who have tried their hardest to make this country a better world, because that's what they truly believe in their hearts, because this is the only place that we know as home. And it was so amazing to me to see that no matter what part of the country we were in, we all have fought really hard to try to get to where they were. And so not only were there so many young professionals there, people who work for immigration services who are BIA certified, people who have just done some amazing things as being the first undocumented on TED Talks. I mean, you have people that I thought I was maybe the only one somewhere in a little town that nobody knew about, and you had people there that were just contributing so much to our community to make it a better place.
Laura, I'm now jealous because I want to do a TED Talk. So I'm jealous that you met somebody who did a TED Talk. I want to be introduced to that.
So I just want to make sure people understand that we are their neighbors, the people that help them in the local pantries. We are there, the people who deliver food to them. We are, and some of us are documented or non-documented. Some people got DACA and stayed with their jobs that they were in, but are more aware and are trying to participate and educate themselves, because that's what's the requirement for the application, to continue their education. So I think people really need to understand that people, all these new DACA recipients who came out of the shadows, are contributing in such large ways in this community now, even more than before, because now they can.
So, Laura, let me tell you, you are the racial justice program manager for the YWCA in Orange County?
Yes.
So tell me what that job entails. What do you do as part of that job?
Part of my job is to create programs to bring awareness about racism in our country. And we have a group of teachers that teach a program called Teaching Tough Topics, where we teach other teachers to have these conversations within the classroom, whether it's any issues with immigration, racism, or sexism. And so the teachers teach other teachers. Another part of my work was to register people to vote for a campaign called Immigrants Vote. And another part of my job is to create programs that are needed in our community to help people understand the systems that we live in and to access the information that they need to better themselves.
So, Laura, could you just share again with our listeners a little bit? The part that intrigues me a lot is teaching teachers how to deal with or teach about tough topics. Can you give us a little example of one of those topics?
Sure. In the classroom, there's a lot of difficulty in trying to bring up any issue, whether it's immigration, particularly because the schools are not allowed to ask the status of any student. So you have students like myself who unfortunately weren't able to get right into college because they didn't know what the steps were to go to college. I didn't even take my SATs because it wasn't part of my culture to understand what the SATs were, and I was a good student. So when we teach the teachers to learn different ways to bring up these conversations is to allow the relationship between the student and the teachers of where the students feel comfortable enough to come up to a teacher and say, well, that's something that I deal with every single day, and to make those students feel more comfortable and to have a safe space to speak up and speak about these topics that are so hard. Teachers have a really hard job when it comes to trying to bring awareness to any other issue.
I know the teachers had a hard job when they were trying to teach me. I knew that was a hard job.
So even racism, as a big topic as it is, it's really hard to try to just bring up a conversation. So what we teach teachers is different methods to do and so, not just to show a movie, but to have a real conversation with the students.
And what's the response from teachers? As you say, the teachers have a hard job. When you say, well, you got to teach people about about hard topics, they say, wait a minute, I got enough to do teaching regular subjects. Now you want me to do this stuff? What's the reaction?
Right. Many teachers, because they have to separate their political views with what they teach, a lot of stuff that's in the books do touch on certain subjects that they just have a hard time teaching on. So a lot of teachers feel really confident when we're able to give them techniques that they can use in the classroom. So to do different projects that brings out this topic and the best of the students into a conversation with the rest of the classroom in a safe place is what the teachers are learning and what they feel most comfortable with. Because what we do is we try to make sure that the workshops or whatever they do in the classroom is according to what the rules are for teachers when they're teaching something. So there's a whole other thing about if you're going to teach something, you have to follow the criteria, right? And so that's what we teach the students, the teachers, not to be afraid to use those tools to teach the right way for students to come out and speak up.
Laura, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for what you are doing. Laura Garcia, who is the Racial Justice Program Manager at the YMCA in Orange County, and she's one of the individuals who was a beneficiary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals that was implemented by the executive order of President Obama about three or four years ago. And so we're delighted that she took the time to be with us. Lori, thank you for what you're doing, and thanks for being a guest on Just Love.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Great. It may be a sleepy month of January, but it's not not super sleepy with the inaugurations coming up, with Dr. Martin Luther King Day coming. And, those two topics in which we spoke with Brother Tyrone and we spoke with Laura Garcia about Dr. Martin Luther King and immigrants. Again, a sensitive topic, which I think my own reading of life is we made a lot of progress. Early on, and when I say early on, I'm talking maybe 50 years ago or so, or 40 years ago or so, there sometimes was a little bit of tension between the Afro-American community and the immigrant community, in which there may have been thought that, when more immigrants were coming into the country, they were taking jobs away from native-born African-Americans. And sometimes there was a little bit of public policy debate and a little tension about immigration policy. I mean, one of the things, and again, my observation is that, there's been a great deal of understanding that, there are a lot of issues of hurt, a lot of issues of injustice, and there's a greater commonality between some of the issues that the Afro-American community is dealing with and the issues that immigrants are dealing with. And I don't sense as much of that tension or divisiveness around the issues of immigration that I did see maybe decades ago. Now, that doesn't mean that the world is perfect. The world is not perfect, and there still are division, there are still tensions. But I do point it out to our listeners because I think we can make progress on some of these social issues. So, you know, I'm delighted that we were able to explore those issues of Dr. Martin Luther King, of immigration, particularly the children, the young people who are here who are now productive citizens, as we kind of move forward in the middle of winter, as we kind of look forward to the transition to a new administration, a new Congress, and probably a new Supreme Court justice. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.